You are listening to Prio Events, a series of recorded public events hosted at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. We conduct research on the conditions for peaceful relations between states, groups and people. Our seminars cover a wide range of topics on war and peace and are open to the public. Visit our webpage, prio.org, to learn more about our institute and future events.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone, and warm welcome to this panel on art, activism, and resistance after the 2021 military coup in Myanmar. Myanmar, as was mentioned in the previous panel, is one of the focus countries of the INSPIRE project. And it's really incredible to have this group sitting next to me. We have here today Zun Mei U, who is the INSPIRE Art Award nominee. Congratulations. She's having, for those who weren't here in Lillestrøm on Saturday, she has an exhibition there with four other nominated artists. And this will be until very beginning of June, so there's time to see it. I highly recommend it. We have Chu Wai, who's many of you already seen in action. One of the most interesting young Myanmar artists, I will say, based in Paris now. We have Sara Wong from the London School of Economics, a PhD student. But also, if not a kind of a practitioner, not as an artist maybe, but perhaps what do I know? But I know her also from producing videos and animation films when she was used to work for the Positive Negatives before. That had been a collaborator of Prio for a long time. I'm just going to remind everybody that the recording is the session is being recorded. If anyone have problem with a question or something that they would like to erase, it's possible, but we'll try to have a recording on the event page of the Prio website so everyone knows. Also a PhD student is Ida Fagervoll, UiO, University of Oslo, Human Geography. And we should have had Trude Stopnes here, also a PhD student and the INSPIRE project own PhD student, but she's on maternal leave having her baby, so she's very much excused. Also contributing from afar is two Myanmar artists that are both refugees, one in Thailand, one in Bangladesh. Kukul and pacifist Farouk will show some videos that they've made. And my name is Marte Nilsen. I'm a senior researcher working on politics, culture, and religion in Myanmar for more than a decade, maybe close to 15 years now. Also working with the Burmese diaspora and refugees in Thailand and Bangladesh. For illustrating this event is a painting by Chu Wai. It's called Burying Yesterday's Headlines. I think it's a very powerful image, and it speaks volumes to the current situation in Myanmar. Myanmar has a history of civil war and military rule. But the coup in 2021 was something that everyone in Myanmar found unacceptable. And young people led a strong and peaceful protest and a civil disobedient movement. And it was a crystal clear message to the junta. Art and activism and artistic expression, popular culture, was a very important part of that crystal clear message. But this movement was met with brutal violence. Sniper shots to the head. Extreme violence in prison. And this clash led to the forming of People's Defense Forces in alliances with ethnic armed organizations that created a revolution that has lasted more than 3 years now. And since the past 6 months, looks like this resistance is winning. I think burying yesterday's headlines is At least to me, it means something about mourning the dead, but also a start of a new era for Myanmar, hopefully. And the Inspire Project, to me, has been a process of analyzing portraits of this revolution. And I've collected snapshots from personal journeys of artistic practices and resistance. And I will touch upon some of these here. I want to start showing a very powerful animation video that a graffiti artist and illustrator, Kukul, made in a very special time when that military had just started slaughtering young activists of the Spring Revolution, around April, May 2021. You see those drawings with flower heads, and she, to this day, she always called the activists and the young activists of the revolution for my flowers. And I want to show the animation she made back then. Kukul is, I think, the first female graffiti artist from Myanmar. We worked with her since 2019, so before the coup, for the Transform Project, we made an animation film, or she made the animation film, about a land rights activist in Kachin State that we work with. So this is how research and artistic practices came together for the first time for me. Kachin State has suffered under decades of civil war. And for Kukul, this was her first visit to that area, and she learned about the suffering for the first time. Everyone in Myanmar is familiar with the war, but many people in central areas don't really understand the reasons for the war, and they've never been really fully told and really never experienced it. So the meeting with the land rights activism and also other people in Kachin State, in Michina, was, I think, a bit of a political awakening for her. Okay, I lost a slide here, but she tells me always, and Sarah was working on making that animation film actually happening, from the research to the artistic, and making that go together. That's not easily done always, so that was Sarah's work. But Kuku says to me, like, I work so well when I'm angry. And I think she was one of the, like, there was so much spontaneous artwork coming out of Myanmar just the days after the coup. And I think a lot of people here have seen that. But I felt that Kuku's contribution was so explosive. And she really expressed some of the really feelings, and still do. So her portraits and pictures are quite simple, but very powerful. And very emotional, to the sort of from the ninja-like banging of pots and pans that everyone was doing immediately after the coup, at the time where the general was having its daily speak on television, the entire country went off in an enormous noise from pots and pans. To as soon as people start walking in the street, this message came out: you messed with the wrong generation. And I saw it in front of the Norwegian parliament the day after, so it really spread very quickly. And there were some actions going on in Myanmar at the time, where military started cracking down on protesters and started to arrest people, that women and protesters would hang female skirts or sarongs in front of their balconies and across wires to prevent soldiers from entering, because it's believed that women garments may harm the masculine power of soldiers. So it was something that, for the 8th of March celebration that year, became like a big thing, that we used skirts as flags. And Kukul also made her contribution together with many others of that. You can see the ethnic patterns, ethnic and minority patterns on the eight flags on the sides and the more contemporary in the middle. And the writing says, our sarong at the main, our flag, our victory. And so that her images express the different, to me, the different emotions, the courage, the hope, dreams, some ridicule and satire, but also the exhaustion and the sorrow that we saw in the animated film, and also anger from the last few images here. This is kind of a timeline of the first year of the revolution. The pandemic hit very hard during the summer, and the exhaustion that people felt from not having oxygen to give to their loved ones, the economic burden from being in a civil disobedient movement, and you see that deity-like, the Hindu deity-like woman juggling all these tasks at the same time, and eventually the armed resistance against the military. Other portraits are more direct. From this artist, he was a protester as well. He's a little bit older, but he was imprisoned in Insein prison, which is Yangon's largest prison. Notorious since the 88 revolution or student uprising in 1988. And he was documenting what he saw in the prison. So since the coup, there's 26,500 arrested, and 20,300 are still detained or have sentenced. So there's a lot of people there. 4,900 people have been killed by the military. So his documentation is to some of these people have died, some are still in prison, some are free, and he got out and he had hidden these portraits. They just found a bits and pieces of paper and they hid it inside the wall of a card box. So just to find a piece of paper to hide the other pieces of paper. And this is how this collection was rescued. So there's been so many people lost in Myanmar and so many people in desperate situation. Not just because of the coup. War has been raging for many decades. And I have also been working with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, who since 2017, there's almost a million people living in the camps now. They lost everything, their homes, their loved ones. Before they already lost their citizenship, and living in Bangladesh also their rights, and there's no way of getting formal education, no chance to make a living, to work. And about sometime last year, pacifist Farouk, this guy here, he's a poet and an educator, and he made a short poem, just a few lines, that kind of spelled out the desperation and the longing for a better future. And hopefully in the new Myanmar that will come, maybe not too long, I'm afraid that Rohingya will be the last people around the table. They will be the last in line, probably. But at least there can be possibilities also for them. So I asked Farouk to read the poem for us. And Kim Althain, who's also known as Abdullah, and is one of the Inspire artists that we have on our growing portal, he filmed Farouk when he was reading his poem. I'll show this to you. It's called A Request. To taste the world, how it is, delicious or not. Just that chance to live as a human being. And with this panel, we want to show some of the connections between research and art. And they really do blend together in strange ways. And it's been really, really exciting to work with you guys and everyone in the Inspire project, and with Trude and everyone. So there's so many connections between the people in this channel, in this panel. So Sarah Wong, as I already mentioned, you work with us in the Transform project with positive negatives. You're now doing the PhD, and you're going to talk about that in a bit. But you worked with Kukul, and you worked with Chuwe. You curated an exhibition with her as part of your PhD, but you will explain. Curation as a method, so I'll give the word to you.
Thank you so much for including me in this conversation today. And thank you to Priya for, this invitation. It's really nice to be here. And like you said, Marta, I think my own work and this project intersect in a lot of interesting ways. And in some ways, I think we've been running in parallel, but we've had encounters in the past. So I think I see our practices as kind of interweaving and braided together. As Marta said, I'm a doctoral student at the London School of Economics. And I was asked today to talk a bit about how I see research and artistic and creative practice in relationship with each other. So I'm going to talk a bit about what I'm calling curation as method, which is a kind of one portion of my PhD research. And in doing that, I'll reflect on kind of my experiences of curating an exhibition with Chu, featuring her artwork, and kind of reflecting on an autoethnographic approach and artist-researcher collaborations, although I'm hoping to kind of trouble that distinction a bit. Just to say, as Marta already kind of alluded to, I think I kind of came to academic research by accident. I do kind of consider myself a research practitioner, so prior to this, I was mostly working in digital media. So this is the first physical exhibition that I've curated. But it's been interesting to see the ways in which my previous experiences of collaborating with artists, working with artists, and producing artwork has been helpful, but also in some ways not at all in terms of learning experiences. So what I'm going to do today, I won't give too much background on my research, because I think Marta already framed what's going on in Myanmar and the role that artists have played really well, so I'll just skip over that quickly. But what I want to do is to talk about the kind of broader methods that I use and situate curation within that practice, and then mostly to have a kind of open discussion on some of the opportunities, but also the challenges in utilizing curation as method. So all of the photos that you see here are photos from the exhibition that I curated featuring Chu's artwork, just to give you context there. I'll skip over most of this because I think it was already touched on and framed really well, but my research intervenes primarily in looking at the role that artists have played in resistance to the coup in and kind of beyond Myanmar since 2021. And I say in and beyond because I have a focus on artists that have been displaced or artists that are working in exile. I think it's really interesting to hear that you've abolished the term exiled artist. I'm very keen to hear more about that, because it's also something that's come up in my research in terms of people that I'm in collaboration with not necessarily wanting to be named in a certain way, right? So I'm interested to hear more about that. So just to give kind of general background of my methods, just to say, I don't necessarily fall within a particular tradition. I'm not an anthropologist necessarily, but I guess I like to say that I have a kind of ethnographic sensibility. I'm a bit of an undisciplined researcher, but broadly kind of qualitative. So I use ethnographic observations at art exhibitions, studios, home studios, art advocacy events, and then I do in-depth interviews with artists like Chu, curators, creative workers, organizers, people that fall in between, and then pair that with kind of visual analysis of the artwork. But what I want to talk more about today is the kind of practice-led element of my research, which involves curation as a method. So collaborating with an exhibiting artist and thinking about those kind of autoethnographic observations that can inform my theorizing. So this reflection as part of my doctoral research is a reflection of an exhibition that I curated called Not Another Protest Exhibition, Myanmar in Revolt and Feminist Art Practice. This was an exhibition that was at the Atrium Gallery at LSE just this year, February 2024. So it was a 4-week in-person exhibition. We had some online events, some in-person events, and it was really kind of the culmination of probably about a year and a half of conversations that Chu and I have been developing throughout our kind of relationship. And the central kind of motivating question that drove this particular intervention in my research was, how can curation practice help us theorize about creative resistance and diaspora? So I've framed this around opportunities and challenges, but I think, as per usual, all of the opportunities were challenges and all of the challenges are also opportunities. So it's a bit of a false binary. But I thought it would just be helpful as a way to kind of start to think through how I'm reflecting on this experience. And also just to say, this is quite fresh still. So, the exhibition was in February. I'm still writing, unlike the Inspire project, which is, you know, in some ways more of a cohesive coming together, wrapping up nice, neatly. I'm still kind of in the middle of my doctoral research. So this is still very kind of live for me. In terms of the conversation that comes, I'm very keen to hear how people have reacted to this kind of work and how that could, you know, even shape my work and writing going forward. Opportunities. So for me, I think the biggest opportunity, and in some ways this gets at the broader overarching theme of this whole conference, this whole project really, as I see it, the Inspire project specifically, is that it opens up a very different way of relating. So what I mean by that is, at the beginning I said, and in the title of this presentation, this is about artist-researcher collaborations, right? But I think what I found throughout our collaboration, and Chu, maybe you can speak about this as well, is that we were always wearing very different hats, right? Like, I think in seeing how research informed your practice and how, you know, you kind of step into the role of the researcher, that inspired me to also put on the hat of the kind of practitioner and the creative, and not necessarily the artist, but to think about how we inhabited those different roles at, in different ways. And in thinking about that, it started to make me think about moving beyond framing my work or thinking about my work as like a case study or a kind of field site or even having, you know, research participants, right? It was very much, this collaboration was very much an organic one, I think, that grew from, in some ways, from our friendship, really, which, yeah, I can talk a bit more about. And in that way, it was a different set of data, again, for lack of better terminology in the social sciences, to traditional qualitative approaches. So unlike it kind of inverts, in some ways it inverts the approach of going about a research project and then perhaps at the end doing public engagement that might be creative or arts-based as a way to get people to disseminate your research findings and to get people engaged with your work. This approach very much inverts that and goes practice-led in terms of leading with a collaborative embodied, relational, affective project, and then trying to make sense of what that actually means. So again, I'm still in that kind of sense-making process. But it's what I'm finding is it's a different set of data, and in some ways, it's ambiguous. It's a bit ambivalent, and in some ways, I don't know what to do with what I've learned. Right, to be completely honest. Another opportunity that I see, and this is more in terms of like thinking about the active and perhaps the political role that we play as researchers, is the role that we can play in actually kind of constituting an archive. So I'm taking that specifically from Stuart Hall's work. But thinking about how the work that we do, and this is something that, you know, I think Prio and the Inspire Project do really well, but how the work that we do actually is part of a broader kind of historical archive, especially for contexts where that archive isn't necessarily there in the digital space or isn't necessarily there in English language platforms or kind of recorded and, you know, as putting my researcher hat back on, recorded in terms of histories, recorded histories, right? I think that relates also to the final point, which is like public engagement is just inherent in the curation process. And I think this is something that given it was an in-person event and questions of kind of the university as the site itself, but also the spatiality of it, this is something that I found really interesting and I'm still kind of working through, because I'm used to working on digital projects where you think about you're thinking about audience, you're thinking about how to make research accessible, but the kind of intricacies of, and you can see here people walking around the space, people interacting with the work, and actually the physicality of being in that space, I found, yeah, really kind of fascinating and an important part of kind of research accessibility. So thinking about what some of the challenges were for this work, and yeah, there were many, and like I said, I'm still thinking through them as well. For me, ethics, like thinking concretely about what it means to do practice-based work ethically, kind of overarches, I think, all of these challenges. So what does it actually mean? What counts as data in these projects, right? What does it mean if you're at an exhibition launch, like I was, and an audience member or someone, an interlocutor, kind of whispers something in your ear that you think, oh, that's really interesting. Can I use that as data? How does this work, right? So thinking about what this actually means, again, because this is framed within the context of my kind of methodological framework, how do I make sense of those kinds of interactions in an ethical way, right? Again, I think that overarches all of those points. And then lastly, this is what I'm currently working through, but how do you then kind of write up and reflect on this process? And something that we've done is we've had kind of follow-up conversations about what this looks like. But one thing that I'm starting to do now is to actually think about, because given the singularity of our kind of collaborative relationship and all that entails, one thing that I'm thinking about now is how I can actually use kind of short vignettes, thinking specifically about like speculative fiction, to try to animate all of those kind of relational experiences that were part of our collaboration, but I wouldn't necessarily ethically want to say the whole and full truth, right? So it's thinking about playing with what kind of political truths are within a kind of fiction framework. So yeah, I think I'll leave it there. Perhaps we can talk more about this in the kind of broader discussion. But yeah, thank you very much.
because you can say I'm an artist and she's a researcher, and also at the same time, whether I accept it or not, or whether it's true or not, I still have the question like, am I an activist? But the activist, you know, artist, and on the side, what I'm doing, some things are also kind of activist work, and also she has some feeling like this, researcher and also curator, but somehow they are supporting and connect to each other. Some part of the scale we can share from the both sides. At the same time, how we gonna, you know, balance between these two and which will help, and you know, it's a lot of questions. So we found a lot of similarity between them, between these two, and yes, the whole project and exhibition was based on the friendships, and I feel comfortable talking to you, and it's really deep sometimes, even though when I have some doubt and thought, which is under the surface, I could really talk and discuss, and sometimes it's bringing another perspective to the exhibition. For example, people tell you that you are a refugee, you have to live in exile, and so the way the artwork that you create, people already expect that this artwork gonna be violent, this one gonna be talking about the horrible thing, depressed, and mostly like that. But inside me, and also I don't want to illustrate this all the time, and also there is another part of beauty which is also resistant, and also the country has a really beautiful history and culture which even the military cannot destroy. So I was really, you know, like on the line, should I follow the creation of people expected, and also I want to have another creation part that I want to create it, but which is people don't really want to accept it, not under the title that they expected. So really works through with this, and that's why the idea of the exhibition was not another proto exhibition, because the way we approach was different from the other kind of proto exhibitions, and we want to go more deeper and also from the different perspective. Also the current affair, bringing and providing the data, the information, what is going on in Myanmar, but from the different approach of a different way of presenting.
Sorry, can I just add on to that? Because I realized I forgot to actually mention what the artwork was.
sorry. We saw it.
You saw it, yes. Maybe that's the important bit. But just, Choose just reminded me, because also it connects really well with the artwork that Marta was talking about in relation to the kind of Tamin hanging practices and the kind of resistance strategy on the ground. In using textiles and female textiles in order to kind of like barricade police and military personnel. So you can see here on the bottom photo, three pieces by Chu that uses that fabric and in some ways commemorates that. So the artwork, the exhibition featured 17 of your paintings or pieces, which were mixed media. They combined the use of textiles, archival photographs, and kind of, again, commemorating this fabric resistant approach that was very much on the ground in Myanmar, but also playing with this idea of ubiquity and sort of asking the question, asking this broader question of what is the relationship between revolt or the revolutionary and the everyday specifically through this weaving practice. So you can see here, this is probably the best photo of it, where the pieces themselves are woven in the style of this
daily
basket.
Yes.
Yeah. And these baskets are, you know, ubiquitous in Myanmar, right? And they're used for everyday objects. They're used for kind of groceries, shop halls, whatever. So the idea was to try to put that into conversation. And again, in a kind of, not necessarily in an explicit way, but in a kind of subtle way to ask the questions. I think you always say that, Chu, your work asks questions, and that relates to the last panel as well. Doesn't necessarily offer easy answers, but it asks these questions about that kind of relationship. So, yeah, I just wanted to add that.
Thank you very much. We'll come back to Chu's work also, but I want first to move to Zumei U. Inspire Art Award nominee, I'll say it again. And you have been working with Trudis and part of Trudis research even before the coup. And you worked before with animations and for the art award now and moving over to puppetry, which is a very strong Myanmar tradition.
Hi everyone, I'm
Sophia. And your exhibition is called The Shadows of Heroes. And I would like to ask you to explain about this award, so the artwork, what it means. Mm-hmm.
And I've been working with animation and illustration as a freelance, and I studied with this in this field. And then for this exhibition at Najat for the Art Award project, I created these puppets, like they were in different boxes, and audience can move them with their hands, so they can be a part of this story. So about this story, this is a kind of revenge story. And these white things are the heroes who will take a revenge to the evil who destroyed their lives, their families, in their past life. So these heroes came from the people who were killed, who were murdered in the fire as the people in Myanmar, as the civilians in Myanmar, by the military. So I don't want to end the story as the death, as the sad ending. So I want to continue the story as the hero. This is how I want to believe them. They reborn as the heroes. They took a revenge and they are victory. So I did them in puppet way because in Myanmar history, puppets played a very important in political role. They were used to convey the message from the people to the people who rules them. So, and they had a privilege to speak out in the country because a king forgive them because they are non-human objects and they are in entertainment way. So this is how I construct my work and the story and present to the audience. Yeah.
And I can reveal that this when we had the opening on Saturday, this was the most popular among the kids because they could play around with them and move the puppets, and there's music you can listen to. And the story is really very interesting and moving in many different ways. So,
yes.
So it for us who know Myanmar and in the audience who know Myanmar very well as well, you recognize very much that tradition of the puppets. But these are done in a different way and in a very beautiful way. And the demon, I asked you about the inspiration for how did you create the demon?
So when I start to think about the story, I started from the end. So we have the ending is our victory. So I started thinking from the end to the start. And it's also like a game and a kid story. So the story is very simple. We took a revenge, we victory at the end. So everything I took in a kid way. Mm. This is how I see and how I imagine when I think about the demon, the bad evil. Mm. So, yeah.
And you said that this is how you always imagined demons.
The demons.
And we can reveal that the end, I think there are five.
There are five images. Boxes.
And the last box, there is a casket with a demon in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Demon funeral. Yeah.
So I encourage everyone to go and see it and listen to and try and be the puppet
part
masters.
Of the story. Yeah.
Be part of the story.
Only one station away.
One station.
5 minutes.
10 minutes. I want to move over. We're going to come back in the conversation but I want to move over to another PhD journey. Ida, another journey of activism, art and research. You're in human geography in the University of Oslo, and you were working with Trude there as well, very spontaneously, in the early days after the coup. And please tell us about that journey from that until your current research.
Thank you. Is it on? Can you? Okay, great. Let's see. So I am going to talk through a narrative of how I ended up doing my current PhD research, which is on queer resistance or queer responses to the coup. So queer resistance in the Burma Spring Revolution 2021. And so I will talk through from the coup, how then different connections and collaborations came to be and led to these exhibitions that you can see there in the middle, and then how that kind of inspired and transformed into a PhD project, which I'm currently doing. So as been said, I was doing this, or when the coup happened, I was a master's student at the University of Oslo, just trying to write up my thesis. And this was a resistance movement that was pretty much streamed online, all of it. So I was following a lot of different activists and artists through social media and trying to follow also what was coming out or how this was picked up in the Norwegian context. And then I came across this podcast episode from Prio called Peace in a Pod that was on the coup in Myanmar and the protest art and technology related to that. And in that podcast episode, Trude Stapnes, she was talking about her project or her PhD research that was part of the Inspire project, and talked about artists and artistic practice as part of resistance. And she said at some point, and I don't think that she thought that anyone would kind of follow up on this, but she said, if anyone wants to learn more or wants to contribute in any way, just send me an email. So I did. And we had our first meeting online because it was mid-pandemic, everything was closed. And I don't know, we ended up talking, I think, for a few hours. I think like the bottom line, what we were talking about is like we wanted to do something. We've both been working with Myanmar for a long time and wanted to do something that was meaningful. So I was writing up my thesis and I wanted to do something that felt, I don't know, more engaging, more in touch with what was going on in the country and try to help or assist or find like ways of contributing somehow. And then following that, I talked to a friend of mine. We were studying together, Hanna Werkland. And she was like, you have to put up an organization. If you're going to raise funds, you have to have an organization, because if not, you're going to have issues with tax and other stuff. So she is the organizational mastermind fixing everything. Trude had all the connections with different artists. I had some network here and there and was like, as we say in Norwegian, the potato, I think, of this whole thing. So we just ended up reaching out to artists inside Myanmar, Norwegian artists, that had been working, collaborating with Burmese artists and also working in Myanmar. And reached through friends, networks, and we ended up connecting with a new Norwegian organization called Youth for Democracy in Burma or Myanmar. So we were pretty much inspired by the resistance, of course, and artistic work, but also that the media, at least in Norway, was very focused on the atrocities made by the military and had a very like dark and, I don't know, gloomy presentation of what was going on. So we wanted to show the resistance and these stories, both personal and group stories of what was going on, and create awareness, and fundraising was also a central motivation in the beginning. So this is the first window exhibition. It was in Bananas in Grönland. It's just close to here. So I said this is a story of like random connections. So Trude was just walking by this space one day and was like, huh, this is a nice window for an exhibition, because everything was closed, so we couldn't do an indoor exhibition. And she knocked on the door and said, hey, you have a nice window. We're doing this thing. Can we use it? And they were like, yes, of course you could use it. And for however long you want. So this is, we did the opening just following one of the demonstrations here in Oslo, and we gather a group of people together and walk down. And so you can see the people, it's maybe a bit difficult to see, but you can see Hanna, the red sweater and red hair in the window, and then to do this about the purple there, and then Annie Joseph, who's part of Youth for Democratization of Burma, and then me on the right side. And we also made had to make a logo and a name and all of these things to make this. And then you see a close-up. It's a video or a 24/7 like going. It's different videos in this. And then on the left of that is Richie Ted with the painting Bitch Better Have My Democracy, which you can see with the red background. And then it's So-Yin with February Salute. And then it's Sarchi with Wake Up the Revolution, which are the red ones just below. So this was the first exhibition. I can't really... Trude was in the headspace of this being her PhD. I was in the headspace of I'm writing up this master's thesis. It doesn't feel really meaningful. I'm doing this instead. So Trude has this very, you know, probably detailed process tracing what was going on. I'm just trying to backtrace. So I can't remember how long this was up. This is the second one in a bar in Grönland, also just close to here. Same artists, and same with the digital or the screen. You can see there Hanna putting up. So this space we got just because Hanna lives just above the bar and knows through that the owner and said, hey, you're not open. It's locked down. You don't use your bar. Can we please use it? And they said yes. And I think also because they often play a lot of loud music, so I think she blackmailed them a bit because she lives just right above them, so she was kept up every night. So I think this was friendship and blackmailing that got us this space, probably. And all the white pieces is information and on how you can buy the prints. And this was the main or the biggest exhibition. So here, well, the first one was the most spontaneous. It just happened, and the people we connected to was kind of the ones who were brought into it. This was also very spontaneous, but a bit more planned, I guess. So we made this, called it a closed call for contributions, because we just connected to a lot of different people and asked them to connect us to artists or creative practitioners, and they submitted work, and we made a selection based on that. So this is the biggest one. It's in the middle of the city center, close to, yeah, you see the big church and some of the main shopping streets. So here, this was also during the pandemic, and the municipality had, the way I understood it, that they wanted to have a more lively outdoor space during the pandemic. So we also were able to have this space for free. And in my email, I said, could we borrow this space for 2 weeks? And then when we met to look at the space, she was like, I don't think we can do 2 months, but maybe 6 weeks. So then we got this space for 6 weeks, which was great. And here we got, I think, some funding from PRIO, and then a lot of funding from companies' social and cultural budget to print them and to transport them, because they're quite, yeah, you can see, they're quite huge to move around. So this is an anonymous artist in the middle, and then Bart was not here, left, and then again Richie Ted with Bitch Better Have My Democracy. Let's see. Am I way over time, Marta? Okay. So I just also wanted to touch upon something that I found interesting, that was maybe the responses to this, the impact. One was maybe created by ourselves, but we it's one newspaper in Norway that has this, it's called Perspective, it's a column on like cultural events. So we submitted a piece there and was on the backside of this newspaper. And then the middle one is from one, again, anonymous artist that I unfortunately lost contact with, that made a painting of the exhibition and then sent it to us, which I think is one of the nicest, I don't know, responses to this. And then on the right side, that has gotten the most or got the most attention, was when Bart's work was, you know, vandalized, defaced, something that actually kind of created more attention. So the story, this was just, I think a few days after we put it up, it was like just like blacking out, and yeah, spray painted, and then this story or the speculations of who did it and why, because this is a picture. It's called Gods and Prophets on Strike, and it's Buddha, Shiva, Muhammad, and Jesus in this picture. So it was Jesus and Muhammad that was removed. So there was a cultural magazine that wanted to have a piece on this. And so they wanted to interview the artist and then talk a bit about the exhibition, but mostly they wanted to try to speculate in who and why it was done. And I really liked Bart's response to this. He was mostly just amused by the speculations and didn't want to kind of contribute in speculating. He said, this can just kind of have a life of its own. It's kind of disconnected from me. And we asked him if he wanted to change it back to put a new poster, but he wanted it to be this the artwork with the response. He's a graffiti artist, so that's just kind of his way of viewing it. And he was just very happy that it had created more attention. So this magazine, I don't have a picture of it because they never let us behind the paywall, which was a bit frustrating. Different story, but it was just interesting that it was picked up and funny that they tried to make a story that was not there, I guess. And then the University of Oslo, Hanna, we're still a student there. Here you see her next to two pictures from Hanreality. Picked it up and made a piece on it on their website to show, I guess, student activism, student engagement. So that was what we did. One large like Instagram account with the exhibitions, these two small window exhibition and this bigger one. So this kind of is what led me to do my, I had no, I think from before, I didn't see any connections between creative work and academic work. So for me, that was like, oh, okay, this is something new. So I was really like motivated and inspired by the artistic work and people of Myanmar, of course, but also getting to know through this project and through this work and through that Prios Inspire project. And also other projects Marte at least is involved with. And then I started to think that maybe I could do a PhD. That could be something else than what I knew as academic work. So I had a lot of discussions with my supervisor at the time. My head is like all over the place. So he helped me structure like my thoughts and emotions and feelings towards this. I had a lot of discussions, I think, with my partner and queer friends on what does it mean to do queer research or work on queer issues when you're a queer person? How does this affect the project? Would it be any, you know, all this, I don't know, iffy stuff that you don't know. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do that. It felt more, it's geographically far away, of course, and being queer somewhere else is different than being queer in Norway, but it's like, okay, this is going to probably go into some stuff. I'm not sure if I want to do that. But working kind of through those things and having my supervisor, Christian Stokke, extremely structured, helped me kind of put this into a research proposal. And I was so lucky to be accepted at the University of Oslo in the Department of Human Geography as a PhD student. I started just 1 year after the coup, exactly on the date. Wow. Yeah, very planned. So this is the space, and my working space is as messy as my initial research proposal was. So I'm now doing what I'm in the middle of it. So it's very confusing at the moment, but what I think is like, I try to see social movements and then the resistance movement as a space of artistic, creative and performative practices. So that's kind of my idea of it, this whole space that was happening or all these like creative explosions as one. And then trying to unpack within that what these queer responses was, what they meant, how it was performed, how is what was practiced, and how then that again relates to or how it fits into the context then and now. Yeah, I think that's it.
Thank you very much. Can I have the pointer?
And
thank you so much. It was a very interesting journey, and I was surprised how quick, from just 1 year, from not being having that in your still finishing your master and starting your PhD. Some other people take longer time. Two-way, you've already been mentioned several times now, and you're a unique and fascinating visual artist. We met, you were already a part of the Inspire project as an Inspire artist, but we met in Paris summer 2022, and we were talking. I was having coffee, you were having hot chocolate. And we were talking about the other project, a project that is kind of the sister project, the little sister project of this project, Popaganda, that I work on, where we focus on the important role of mythology, religious symbolism, spiritual rituals, beliefs in political consultations in Myanmar, also other places, but also specifically in Myanmar, and how these are reflected in art and in popular culture. And Amar Athiha back here, he's also working on the project as a PhD student. And as I was talking about this project, you got more and more engaged, because you said, I always wanted to do like a full painting, 16 large paintings, picturing the Mahasupina Jataka, which is a very traditional like story from the Lord Buddha's former lives. Yes. That's a Jataka. So the specific Jataka is about the six bad dreams of the king of Kosala, or King Pasenadi. So there's 16 different dreams, and the last dream is about goats who are attacking lions. You said, I always wanted to make like all these dreams, because they really speak to me in how Myanmar situation is right now. And since that our meeting, I was thinking like, is there any way I could kind of sponsor, maybe use my project money to sponsor her, like to get started? And as we talked about this final conference, Kaja was saying to me, she was already sketching this series. And we got in touch again. And you started painting. We should have had it framed here, but it arrived with DHL 5 minutes before the panel. So it's here, and it will be framed during the break. But it looks something like this. No, now everything's there. You have it. So I want you to explain about the inspiration behind it, and about the thinking about the series that you want to make, and about this specific painting as well.
Yeah, so, hello. All my life, in my creative career, I always interested in the history and the past, and like vintage newspaper and like the history part. But a majority of my part is mostly focused on the women and women life, resistance, and it's really feminist part, focus on the women, how they were in the resistance. But this part is, I think this came from me, the interest from the vintage black and white movie films, and also the history of Myanmar. And I found the 16 dream of the king from a long time ago, from the myth and the history, because he has very weird dream, which is not unusual, like which is not realistic. It's like surreal dreams, and then every dream has the meaning of the repressing the society, but which is the definition of the dream at the time was from a long time ago, from the society from a long time ago. But when I think when I look at this dream, and when I see the definition of the dream, and it is not only from the Asian society and Asian people, it's also really reflect what is happening right now. And I really wanted to recreate this dream, but in a which reflect the current affair. So when Mata told me to start this series, I have to pick a dream. I have a few sketches to transform it into a real artwork. So I was thinking which one I would start. I would start from 1 to 16, or from the middle I would pick, or from the last. And then I found this one is really touching. This is the last dream, the 16 dream. Because in the dream, the king is dreaming, is the goats are attacking the leopard and they are hunting them. So the leopard, they are so scared and have to run away from the goats. And the meaning of the dream at this time is like people who's doing the bad part, like evil people, they are ruining and they just like became a main character, and the others good people and a good thing to do, they have to run away, they have to so afraid of it. That is the definitions of the dream. And then I was, wow, this is what is happening in Myanmar, because all the educated young people and who just want adjusted and who they the right way, you know, that they voted and is supposed to be the elected winning voter party should be their leader. And then the military, they are ruling the country by using the guns and power, and all of us, and not only the young people, young educated people, and also the society, and then the children, a lot of villages have to move and run away in the forest. Because they are bombing and using air attack to the cities and villages, including the festival and the schools and hospital, this kind of public places as well. So, and when people moved, it's not only where they moved the camp, and even people already moved from their homes and they relocated like a really, like a tent and in the temporary place, and even they attack to the temporary place. So we have a lot of story, like people have to move 2 or 3 times. They have the fears of like this attack is following by them, and is this really daily life is happening right now. And also at the same time, the other side is like the good part is recently we also winning a little bit, and I really hope that we will keep hold of this resistance as well. So, and when I see this steam dream, it might have a different meaning, but the way that he see is in the dream is still reflecting of this society. So I decided to do that, but it's haven't finished, it's ongoing. So, and I really want to put some embroidery and some crochet on the some part of the faces as well. Yes, so you can see books and the forest in the corner.
So it's been, you've been working on this for the last couple of weeks, and you were working on it last week, and then you had to send it. So it's not this, it's getting finished, but it's not yet finished. But the idea is for you to finish it while you're here. So she came on Friday with a suitcase full of paint, but there was no painting. Yes. But now it's here, so yeah. So we're very happy about this. But so the whole Jataka is all these 16 dreams is really about like what happened to a society when the wicked people rule, and then the world turns upside down. Goats will attack lions, and there's a bunch of other weird things happening in these dreams. And for every Burmese and every Buddhist,
yeah,
will know these very well, because these are murals in the temple. You will see them very, yes, many places.
Like the monastery and temple, when you enter, it's like on the sidewalk. It's they were doing this dream, but in a really traditional way, or in a Myanmar traditional way, or realistic way. But now I wanted to go a little bit crazy.
And connect it, yeah, to what is going on, and with students running over the borders. And you see the books and the student hats, and while the bombs are falling. So it will be available in the gallery later on, or here, or we will find a space for it. Let's just move into a conversation now, and we can take questions as well after a while. I just want to start with you, since we're already in a discussion, is because you're really starting to gain like an international reputation as well. I mean, I might be, because of the Propaganda Project, I'm following a lot of galleries, specifically in Thailand, and she's been in every gallery in Thailand, but also but also in Europe, becoming like a name for Burmese artists. But can you tell us a little bit about that journey? And how is the audience different in, you touched a little bit upon it, but when you're in Paris and in Norway, and how is the audience different from in Thailand or Myanmar, and how do they interpret things, and what do they expect of you and expect of your art? Can you say a little bit about this?
Yes. So when I arrived, because I was always with my art and in my country, because of the art, but after a few months of the coup, and I have to flee, and when I arrived, DEPA wasn't easy, and I have zero opportunity, a lot of rejections, and as I told you, when I arrived, I do more feminist and focus about women's situations. So when I proposed to, I'm an artist from Myanmar, I arrive, I do this kind of feminist art in Europe, but I was surprised because they think at that time the current affair, like the open call, the budget, and also the exhibition we want to do, they think feminism is a bit old school, a bit outdated. It was trans on the back a few years ago, but it's, for the moment, it's not their main interest. They're more interested in the other topics. So I got a lot of rejections and refusions, and I, for about 6 months to a year, I was zero opportunity, and I couldn't really live as an artist. I was really thinking, like, should I give up, you know, maybe for my living, to pay for the food and the shelter. And then at the same time, if I do the create the hour, focus about the revolutions in Myanmar, like the current, the revolution in Myanmar, there might be some more chances and more exhibitions going on. But at the same time, what I present is a bit, you have seen a bit, I don't say directly, a bit more humble and more, you know, like for the people who already know about Myanmar, it's really interesting because it's go deeper the surface. But if you don't know about Myanmar, it's not really direct way of illustrating the horrible thing happening right there. So for the people who make the exhibition, they don't want to put my hour. They think my hours are not violent enough. And also in the other creative side, if I do kind of feminisms and focusing about women, they feel a bit too general. So at first I was difficult, and then I was where I changed the way I paint the Stein to keep living and to make activities as an artist, or where I create something as what I like, and I do something for living on the site. And then I wasn't really sure. And then, you know, artists, we are stubborn. And then if I can feel it, if I can create it, I really, the hours are not really good. So I keep doing what I believe, what I do. And after years and years, and then people started to notice the current affair is not only illustrating the horrible thing, what is happening in Myanmar, this also have deeper things. Because in my painting, I was focused, what is happening right now is not only happening just right now. It has a lot of connection from the past and from the history and even maybe from the colonization. And we have a two coup before, like 1962 and 1988, and the third times has happened. And also technology included. So a lot of things have changed. And let's say even this one is what is happening right now is if we win, it's not only moving someone who ruling the taking the power and changing to the moving this power to a one person. It's not simple like that, because Myanmar, since the British left, once we have the independence, never have been peace. We were always under the military. So it's not only about changing the rules, who's ruled the country or move to the someone, even though that we give the a letter winning party, because the military, they were using culture, traditions, religions, and education to be sure that people are afraid of living with the fears and the mindset they put on us for so many decades. Because when you ask someone from Myanmar, are you afraid of are you afraid of military? Are you hate military to move? And they will say yes, 100%. Because this is a majority, except a small groups of people, they will say yes. But without realizing, they are accepting the idea, the military using all these things as a propaganda, as the strategy, and even sometimes they even use monk, and even the education that we are learning from strategically make a written by the military, and we learn no politics and no art at the government school. No, because according to the past, they were so afraid of well-educated young people because these are the people who created the problems in the past. So they make it sure not really educated. So what I found out in my artwork is I really want to point out and ask the question to the people, what you're doing right now, what you're believing right now, is this or is it from the past? Or it's mostly like in a teasy way. And then also I mess with the culture backgrounds and doing that, and I ask the questions. So when you have a common backgrounds, a little bit of sharing what is happening in Myanmar, like in Thailand and in our regional, they feel more connected and they understand it because we share some history. And when I show the artwork in Europe, sometimes people see just the beauty of the fabric first, because I use a lot of hand-woven fabrics and fabric from my country, and they say, oh, this is different techniques, unique, and why that you use the fabric? So even the reason of using the fabric is the feminist and revolution, how this the idea of the patriarchal involved is really interesting, so the background. So, and I think through my hour, I could also introduce to the deeper level people who doesn't know a lot about Myanmar culture and also about the history, but at the same time, it's giving the information, and not information what is going on there, but also in a little bit more connected to the past and culture and history, and making them to ask the question of the future of what's going to happen next. Mm. So I think it's interesting. I'm happy.
And in addition to this painting, you brought one of those traditional using fabric and the skirts and the sarong as the canvas. Mm. So hopefully we'll be able to see that as well. Because you told me that this is a practice that you've done long before the coup.
Yes.
And that you had an exhibition in Yangon and the painting was sold. And you make quite large paintings as well. But the workers who were going to move the painting from the gallery to the buyer's house, they had a very hard time of handling this specific painting because...
Figuring out.
How are we going to touch... When we touch this fabric, what does that... So they were very insecure about moving the
because this fabric, I was using the women, the bottom part, so we just consider like maybe 100 or maybe 99% of the families follow the rule. You don't wash together with this clothes, with the man clothes, and the most important is it doesn't hang together the same level. For sure, it's already lower level or never higher than the male shoulder because they believe this will kill the masculine glory and good legs and powers. And this is everyone believe it. Because doing it like you're drinking a coffee every day, they don't even realize in it what is the mindset behind. So you can see if you Google like a Myanmar Revolution frontline, you will see a clothes are hanging there. And if you're not from the culture and you might wondering the people are fighting, what the clothes are doing it. Actually, the military, they're not brave enough to walk underneath. So they have to remove it down, take it down, so we have more time to hide and run. So, and this is really believe it. So in my artwork, I use it. And also when I show it on the wall inside my country in Myanmar, often the main audience they get confused. This is the artwork, but still using this fabric and higher than their shoulder. So they're considering it as an artwork, or they're considering it somewhat, if they around there, it's going to bring their good luck some charm. So it was really interesting the way these months react.
And this concept of poem is something also Amara is writing about in his thesis. So when that's coming out, you can learn more about this as well. Zumeu, I can't tell you how excited I am that you're actually here, because for those in Norway, you might know that it's not given that you are able to have visitors from Myanmar to Norway because of immigration laws. So I'm so happy that you're here.
Me too.
You study in Thailand now, and a little bit similar question, maybe, but in Myanmar and Thailand, like everybody knows what is going on in Myanmar. Mm. okay, maybe not every all Thais do, but many Thais also now know what's going on in Myanmar. It's very close to them, and it's in the news. It's always a constant reminder. And now you come all the way to Norway, and you meet the other Inspire nominees, and you in the residencies here in Oslo and in Lillestrøm. Mm. So I wonder, like, how is it to communicate the story of the puppets and the heroes and your background as an artist to this very international audience? And how about meeting the other artists? Like, you're from different places around the world, you're different ages, you're different artistic practices. Can you tell me a little about the beginning of this residency?
Yeah, it's very, like, this is my first time out being out of the Southeast Asia. I have been only to Thailand, except from my country. So this is very different. And I got a lot of new experience for me. And also working with the other international artists and also the curators from Niger, it's really a good experience for me. And yeah. When I moved to Thailand, I didn't have the some kind of culture shock. But arriving here, I got some. Yeah, the way we communicate. Because in Myanmar, as Chiwe said, so we had really different culture. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Have you what have you learned from the other artists that you've been working with here?
Actually, it's a lot. But yeah, before I came in here, I talked with the Daria and also the Zara at our place. I had this guilty feeling for being here before I talked with them. Because, you know, there are a lot of people struggling in the war zone and dying in those areas. And why I am here is also because of those events happening in Myanmar. So it's quite, I am also working on my works at the same time, I'm feeling guilty for working for my works instead of struggling in the war, instead of being the one of them, not being one of them. So yeah, but when I talk with them, they said me like, no, it's not your fault. There won't be anyone who will help you for your struggle. Yeah. Mm. So yeah, so I can relieve those feelings a little bit than before I talk with them.
It's the term is called survivor guilt.
Yes. Yes.
And I think it's something that a lot of people experience.
Yeah, of course.
In this extreme situation. But of course, you know, we as human beings, we are doing very different things and have a different approaches. And you are doing yours in a very important way. So we're all just drops in the ocean anyway. But but the, you know, there wouldn't be an ocean without it. Mm-hmm. But so it's really great to have you here again.
Yeah.
And I know that you have a lot of interesting projects in Chiang Mai as well at the university, and that this is just a one step on that journey as well.
Yes, I am also thinking to develop this story in different art forms like animation, illustrations, and paintings, and sculptures. So yeah, a lot. Mm-hmm.
And Chiwe was telling me that I'm so proud of Zume.
Yes.
She's from my country and she has this major exhibition.
Yeah, I'm so proud of her artwork. Before I have seen her, I was worried. It should be, please. It's a good hour. Because I'm going to introduce a lot of people, you know. Myanmar Hours showing in Oslo, and she's the only one in the exhibition. So when I see it, I thought, I love it. And I'm proud. I'm relieved.
Sarah and Ida, as academics, we write. I think it was in the last panel, you were saying, Paolo, you were saying that. I don't can't remember, but that words are sometimes insufficient or not very good at, like, really, like, they're descriptive, but they can't really describe anyway things that are things that we're working on, something that are so visual or embodied or... So this is something in the Inspire project we've been struggling a lot with. Not Kasia, she's like, oh, it's all fine. It's going to be... But for me, sometimes I'm like, well, how do I put this in a journal article? do you have any reflections on this kind of... How do we put into words?
I think I have a very short, and I think this is might be the... as academics, we're supposed to write. And I think that just this you're touching upon now, since I'm in the middle of my project, this is the reason that I just can't write at the moment, because it's so difficult to try to, I don't know, capture it or put it down or, I don't know. So I don't think, I don't know about you, how you feel about the writing process of this.
We are supposed to write as academics. That's what I'm told. Yeah, no, I it's something that I struggle with, but also find really interesting as well. And it's why in thinking about reflecting on the exhibition, why I've started to turn to speculative fiction, because I just found, I found that I couldn't ethically tell the quote-unquote empirical truths of my research without kind of blending some of elements of truth and fiction. But it's not... It's not a perfect answer to that question, because there's still so much ambivalence and ambiguity and like affective experience that you can't capture in writing. So I think what I'm learning, and part of the learning process, especially in the practice-led element of my research, is like sitting with that, sitting with knowing that a lot of my quote-unquote research findings are not capturable, right? And in some ways, thinking about curation beyond just like traditional art curation, curating for an exhibition, I think thinking about curation more broadly and expansively has helped me think through that, because writing is curation, right? You're inherently leaving stuff out. So it's more so like, how am I as a writer curating, even beyond, you know, creative-led work, how is thinking about writing as a curation practice centering like the, I don't know, the violences that we're a part of in writing, because you can't write everything and it doesn't always speak to the experiences that you want to talk about. So yeah, it's kind of an incomplete answer, but yeah, thinking through fiction has helped me, but it's still, there's still a lot I think that I know will just kind of live in me or in our relationship or in the relationship with my other collaborators that isn't capturable.
I regret my answer of saying I don't write, because I do, but I was just thinking about writing as this like final product that's put somewhere. But I think, well, you had what you call speculative fiction. For me, like a lot of queer methodologies has helped me kind of Not I think, and write up any of this work yet, but trying to write my way through what I've been doing. And as the previous panel made me think of this, like some of the scholars within queer methodologies or queer geographies talk about like sameness and distance and difference, which I think it's based on Donna Haraway's situated knowledge term. But that I just... to kind of write or talk through this, like that we illuminate parts of a story or parts of a picture or certain narratives, and that those narratives come out of these conversations that of course it's a distance between people with very different experiences, but also that it's created through this like sameness, in a sense that you kind of identify with someone in a specific time, that I going into those like dynamics of identifying with someone and then creating a space of sameness, and then also realizing when kind of distance and difference appears, kind of helped me engage with this question of what am I actually able to say something about or to shed light on or illuminate, and what is kind of, and where is the distance, and that is nothing wrong with having kind of both within research, because you can't really see all of it. Yeah.
And there's, of course, many different ways of doing it now. So your former boss, Bendix, who was also doing his PhD, which ended up being a graphic novel. So it's a cartoon, like cartoon expressed journey of his experiences in Vani in Sri Lanka, where he used to work as a UN officer and was evacuated, and his feelings about leaving everyone behind and what happened to the people he knew there. And Cindy, so this is all coming together. So Cindy was, I think you were in the commission. No, what's it called? Like in the defense commission, yeah, for that PhD. And Kasia, you and your colleagues write the book about methods and arts-based methods, and that came out recently. You had just your book coming out about how to approach research in a different way. I think it's in the back corner over there, so you can have a look. If anyone wants to raise a question or comment, please go ahead and raise your hand, and we'll send around the microphone again. So please welcome to engage.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories and your work. Absolutely fascinating, really fantastic. We talk a lot about performing resistance. I'm wondering what, within that, within a concept of conflict resolution, what performing peace would look like. And I just had a question because I loved the project with the puppets. Absolutely love the puppet. I adore puppetry. And you mentioned that people within that could operate the puppets. So my question was more about do they as the puppeteer have to leave the story the same, or do they have the capacity to actually change that story as the puppeteer?
Okay, so in Myanmar history, is there puppeteers? Yeah, they perform them. They do their performance for the people and for their king, for the monarchy. But in my work, I created in different way to, because I want to be the audience as a part of the story, as a part of their whole work. That's why I want them to control the handle and move them. Yes.
But can they change the narrative? The narrative is set. The story is set, right? So you can't really, you can't move them freely around. There's a scene going on in each.
Yes.
You have to stick to the story because we want the demon to end up in the casket in this.
Because we have to end with the victory.
No other ways.
Yes.
That'd be a good question. Anyone else want to?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Iselin Fridenlund. I work on Buddhism and politics, and I would really just say that this is a wonderful panel, and thank you for sharing your reflections, really. My question goes to this using tradition but also challenging tradition at the same time, and we know that Buddhism plays a very ambiguous role during the Spring Revolution in Myanmar, and I'm just inviting you to share your reflections on how you see the role of Buddhism in all this. You have a particular way of dealing with the Jataka stories. And I'm just wondering, how is that perceived by different audiences? Do you have any reflections on that? Thank you.
Yes, Buddhism in Myanmar is strong. And the peoples are very conservative. So if there is some changes, if you don't really want to see, it's really, really tough. The society response. Without touching the Buddhism yet, the fabric that I'm using, because when I started this idea, the way I wash the clothes and the way I hang the clothes in my house, I change. So see, my father is not really happy. Every time after I hang the clothes and I hang the same level, but after maybe a few hours when I back, someone have moved.
So the whole family know that I'm really strong and passionate about this idea, so they want to support me at the same time, but maybe this is a bit too far. So I don't know who, but there is already this fabric is removed. And I remember my auntie and also the grandparents, and when they came and visit to the house, and then they have seen that I'm doing this, and they blame me, and also not only me, they really criticize and blame my moms and the parents, how they behave, how could you raise the daughter like that. So when I realize this, when I believe in one idea, when I'm fighting for this, it's not only me and also people who surround me have to suffer, and sometimes like a couple of years, a few years, the whole families, the whole society, like the pointing the finger and blaming it, it's happened. And when I make the exhibition, the same, a lot of audience, the way we react was really tough. And the same, this is not Buddhism yet. And the same, it's just only the culture, but they think it's come from the Buddhism, but which is not really true, come from the Buddhism. It's really delicately twisted. You cannot really remove one thread. This idea is came from Buddhism. This idea is came from tradition. But actually, in Buddhism, it's never say that. It's not really like that. But a lot of people believe this is from Buddhism, but actually, it's kind of a traditions of culture, and people really think this is really twisted. And the reason behind it is in the one you touch, the Buddhism is really sensitive, and it can create a lot of conflict. It can create a lot of the arguments between the people who believe in Buddhism. And sometime in my artwork, and I was asking the question, when they argue and criticize you using the Buddhism, and I asked the question, but are you sure is this a real Buddhism? Are you sure that you cannot hand the clothes together? And are you sure that we cannot touch this Buddhism history part? Is it sometime in some ways or another patriarchy system, the military is involved and as a strategically? So I think in the future, I'm maybe one or another through the hour, I hope I can separate it and make people to have a little bit of inspirations or a little bit of idea, like a little bit of separation from Buddhism, because Buddhism is not that complicated, and sometimes people know it's not that complicated, but one is twisted with the traditions and the idea of someone involved as some poisonous the ideas is a little bit touchy. That's why I said Myanmar people, when you ask, they hate military, but sometimes they accept the idea because they think this idea is not come from the military. This idea is the Buddhism history, but actually a real Buddhism is not that, you know. So it's, I think it's very conservative, but I think it's slowly, slowly, without, you know, fighting them, pushing them too much, and just slowly changing and making them questions. And I think it's going to be a long process. It won't change within 1 or 2 years, but it's a long using the art, like social media and kind of soft form, like a soft power with movie and through a little bit of their education, I think is going to be slowly have changed, and they will see different through the poisonous idea and the area Buddhism.
Thank you. I think you have really reminded us so strongly. My name is Ragne Birtelund, and I have been a former ambassador to your country and in the region. Your presentations and these projects are really reminding us about the subtleness of the codes and then how culture can be used as a new kind of resilience. Women were not really, for centuries maybe, and not really recognized as they had a inferior role. Now, at the very beginning, as Marta was talking, women immediately, when the Spring Revolution came, were so innovative. They were so much at the forefront. Now, situation has become very complicated, but you have taken the ball, so to say, and creating a space and possibilities for women to address some of what you replied to the previous question, and which gives hope, I think, for the future, that it's about getting a total new system, but really getting women to play a key role and not to see themselves as inferior, but really as a very special force that can help transform and in soft ways can rebuild a new Myanmar. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And I was just reminded another connection, Kuku, that we did the animation that we showed earlier on. You and her did a book some years ago.
Like Women in Power.
Yeah, Girl Power, I think it was called. Power, I don't know in Burmese, but it was made in Burmese and in a translation to English. So I think it's still available. You did your illustration for that. Mm. No, so culture is, of course, always changing. It's nothing static, but it's a competition and it's a struggle and it's a conversation. Kasia, did you want to?
No, I'm privileged. You know, I can have conversations beyond the panel. Thank you so much to all of you, really, for your very thoughtful reflections. And I think I just wanted to make a comment on this idea of writing. I think the two of you are in a tough situation because you have to do your PhDs or, you know, you have to, unfortunately, you have to write something. I think with the writing question that we are struggling in the Inspire project is that it depends at what stage in your academic, unfortunately, career you are. If you're starting, if you're writing your PhD, you have to write, even if now maybe you can do partially, you know, a film or some type of other comic book or whatever, you still have to write. That's the discipline. Like the artists have also there, you have your own disciplines within which you, to some extent, you have to stay. Mm-hmm. But the freedom comes later. So once you get through these different stages, then you can kind of do other things, like the crazy idea that we had with Nitya and the exhibition, right? That's not going to add any points in the academic career, but you do something that is extremely meaningful. Mm-hmm. The exhibition that you did on the streets in Oslo, this is very meaningful in other ways. So I think, I know it's for young academics, it's you're stuck in that paradigm of writing, but think that it's a stage, you know, and later on, you will be able to use all your wonderful talents and ways of telling the stories otherwise, whether it's through words or whether it's through movement or whether it's through an exhibition. So there is a bit of hope, but later, all right? That's for the academic world. But thank you. I think your projects are really important in opening up other disciplines, because in anthropology, we've had this type of discussions for a while, but the fact that you're coming from geography, from political science, I think this is really important that we're having these discussions in other disciplines and that, you know, people from other disciplines are interested in listening to stories otherwise and narrating them. So continue, please. That was more of a comment.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we're looking forward both to the finished PhDs and the future artwork of these two young and promising. Hopefully you can come back here at another stage, maybe also with Kuku and with even Farouk. Would be wonderful to have them being able to travel and be free. We're going to end this panel now, but it kind of moves organically into a lunch. So thank you so much to the beautiful panel. Thank you so much for the audience.
Thank you for listening to PRIO Events. For more interesting and thought-provoking content, listen to PRIO's Peace in a Pod, a monthly podcast where we invite researchers and industry experts to discuss issues on conflict and peace.